Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. It's your future. Let Zurich help you protect it. Talk to us today about life and serious illness cover.
Thank you, Joanne Cantwell, very much indeed. Now, the United Nations says it has had to temporarily suspend its aid operation in the Gaza Strip because of Israeli military evacuation orders in the centre of the Palestinian territory. My next guest has decades of experience as a paediatrician and contributor to humanitarian aid work around the world. Dr. John Kaler is the co-founder of Med Global, an international humanitarian aid organization who has visited Gaza several times in his work. And I'm delighted to say he joins us now on the line. Dr. John Kaler, you're very welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure and a privilege to have you on. As a doctor, I know that you have more than 25 years, is it, experience of working in crisis zones, and you believe you had seen the worst the world could offer.
I had believed that. I thought Camp Moria on Lesbos Island for the Syrian refugees was the worst. It actually had been the worst place I had ever been until I walked into Gaza at the middle of January.
What did you see in Gaza that made it worse?
Well, there are three components to it that made it worse. First of all was the scope, meaning 100% of the population is affected. At that moment, I was in Rafah, and Rafah had not been invaded yet, but it had gone from a population of 150,000 to a population of 1.2 million in the matter of 3 months. So the scope of the population, I mean, the scope of the trauma was there. The second thing was, there was no place to escape to. In most of the places I've been, Syria, Yemen, even Haiti, people could escape, not legally, and not easily, but they could escape. There was no escape here. And third was the paradox that I could literally see the aid. I could throw a rock from where I was and hit the food, and yet it couldn't get in. So just there was no electricity. The infrastructure was completely destroyed. So it was like being in a post-apocalyptic movie. It was so eerie.
How would you describe the suffering you saw then? People suffering.
Well, so there's two things. One is I'm a pediatrician, and so I have 12 grandchildren, and so the nightmare of taking care of all of these young children who, this was January, the first time I was in after the crisis, 100% of the kids were sick, and 100% had illnesses that in Ireland or the United States would just be considered minor illnesses, lower respiratory disease, bad cough, diarrhea. But literally none of those could be taken care of because, A, there was no a home to keep them separated in. These are talking about people jammed into tents of 20. There was no all those normal things that you would do to take care of your children and grandchildren. We didn't have clean water, new Pampers, creams, none of that stuff. So it was heartbreaking. And even though I wasn't in the hospitals, I was there, but I mean, I didn't work in the hospitals where you see all these horrendous, horrendous pictures of trauma. If there was 1,000 patients in the hospital, there's 2 million patients in Gaza. So, and everything had been destroyed. So, so you put it in that perspective.
And in Rafah, the town you mentioned there, you worked in a makeshift kind of clinic with three Med Global colleagues, some of whom we've had on the program. We've had people who've worked with Med Global in Gaza, and they've described as you're describing.
Yes.
Horrible accounts, traumatic accounts.
Well, those are colleagues that have been, so we did two things. This was the senior, I'm one of the co-founders of Med Global. We went in with a set of senior executives, and two of them went to the hospital, and those are the horrible things you're hearing. I mean they're non-describable. And I opened up a primary health center. This is all with our team on the ground, because remember, our team has been there since 2019. These are all Palestinians, and so they had been on the wall since October 7th, and they were helping us set up. They set up the clinic for us. We saw 500 to 700 patients a day.
What?
And they talk about it as primary health care. But
how,
think about how much,
John,
you can.
How can you see 700 patients a day?
Well, that's so. So it wasn't just the three of us who were in the clinic. We also have, when we employ, remember, the people who are displaced are you and me. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're nurses. So there are plenty of healthcare workers that had been displaced from the north to the south. We employ them. That's how we build our program.
But I mean,
but
I can't.
Said,
sorry,
but your question is exactly correct.
I can't get my head around it. I can't get my head around it.
Don't try to get your head around it because you won't be able to. So you see these people. This and you say it was a makeshift clinic, but it was under a roof, mm-hmm. meaning we had built it out. We also had wound cleaning. We cleaned 150 to 200 wounds a day. Post-traumatic wounds from the war, and we did all of that without anesthesia. Okay. So there was crying from the second we started till the second we ended, and that wasn't just the children.
Yeah. Did you lose many children, John?
Not in the clinic. There were several that I sent off to what was then, there were actually three functioning hospitals in the immediate area at that time, no more, mm-hmm. at that time. And we actually did lose a couple to dehydration, to infection, mm-hmm. things like that. But it was a minor number compared, obviously, to the numbers.
In the grander context, yeah. I hope this isn't too callous a question now, but given that you're a pediatrician and that you've worked in crisis zones for an awful long time, does it affect you, or how does it affect you when you lose children that could have been saved, as you say, if they were here in Ireland or in the U.S.? Or,
of course, I would be lying to you to tell you that this doesn't affect me. I wake up every night still thinking of not just the kids I saw, because the kids I saw were illnesses. Remember, the first symptom of hunger is pain, right? You know it. I know it. Mm-hmm. 6-month-old doesn't know why he's hurting. So to see these kids and their families in a situation where there wasn't not, it's got nothing to do with me, whether I could do anything. You could see it in the family's eyes. You know, these are folks that have been displaced 2 or 3 times by the time they saw me. Their kid was sick. They needed something. I couldn't give it to them. So it haunts me. Not the kids who died. I mean, obviously, the kids who died, that goes without saying. But the general suffering, the general level of inhumanity to the man was something I had never seen. And remember, I've been in Haiti after the earthquake. I've been in Yemen. Mm-hmm. I've been on memorials. It's just the level of despair. Resilience tied to it, but despair was enormous, yeah. Absolutely enormous.
And what do the parents say to you, say the parents of a 6-month-old who didn't have the means or couldn't feed their baby?
Let me break it into 2 categories for you, all right? It's the basically healthy child. Because remember, so we're only 10 months into this. Not only, please. We're 10 months into this. I was there when we were 4 months into it. And at every moment, every day you say, this can't get worse, and every day plus one it does. So the level of just general concern, as in the plead of, can you help me? Can we get this? Can we get that? The answer was simply no, I can try. So there's that population. Mm-hmm. But the other population were obviously the kids with severe illness, kids who had cancer, who had been going to, say, Jerusalem or Tel Aviv to get their care before. You know, this had all been approved. That stopped on October 7th, hard stop. Those kids did not get any more care. And it took forever to get any kids out. And there's something, my understanding now, and this number might not be correct, but it's in the right ballpark. My understanding is there are at least 10,000 kids with various, 10,000 people. Whether they're all kids or not, I don't know. Various and sundry things that are literally cleared to go out. They just can't get out. So there's 2 groups. There was ones that are just generally frustrated, but then there's ones who have kids with life-threatening illnesses. Those we've lost. There's no questions on those.
So aid can't get in, and kids who are sick and need treatment can't get out.
That's, you said it perfectly. Aid can't get in. our kids can't get out, and both sets, the aid workers on one side can see the inside, and those kids in the inside can see the outside.
That alone, that in itself is a torture, isn't it?
That in and of itself is a crime against humanity.
Come here, you're overseeing efforts to participate in the WHO UNICEF-led polio vaccination, which is desperately needed there, we know, because polio, if it's not done quickly, could be rife.
Yes. Vaccines crossed in yesterday. I've seen pictures of them crossed in. Obviously, for safety reasons, where they're being cached and the sites of distribution are being kept pretty close to the vest. I have no concept of how they're going to do this without a ceasefire.
Really?
You know, the concept of paying attention to what you know, the concept called deconfliction. That's one of the things that's been thrown around a lot. COGAT is the organization, the Israeli organization that takes care of all of this stuff. You call in the morning, you give them your coordinates, and then those coordinates are supposed to be safe. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yes.
Well, go ahead and ask the World Central Kitchen and ask UNRWA how well that works. So the concept now of, and we're using a clinical model and not a public health model. Public health model would be sending workers, they call it door-to-door. Well, unfortunately, there's no doors to be door-to-door in this, right? So public health model sends workers into the community with the vaccine. Easy to distribute, there's no shots, it's oral, it's a simple pinch of a little container.
So it could be done.
It could be done, but you can't do it.
And then you look at efforts to broker a ceasefire, and let's be kind and say the shifting sands of that negotiation. And it's very hard to see.
I mean, you hear it every day, and the scary thing about it is you hear. So now it's Cairo, I guess. So now they're in Cairo, along with you know, the Americans trying to go through this. Well, the worry is every time you hear this, you know, the other side of the equation is that there's going to be more bombing going on. It's been that way for 10 months.
It's just,
it's scary.
It's a difficult listen, I must say, but it's a great privilege to have you on the programme, John, and hopefully we will talk again. Med Global is doing superb work, and we've got first-hand accounts of your work here on this programme on numerous occasions, and now with you yourself, a co-founder of Med Global, Dr. John Kaler. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much. Anytime. Thank you so much.